All right, so we have nanotech. Before we start on the issues, are there any sort of general questions or points about nanotech that strike people? All right, I hope that this chapter helps persuade you that the future is likely to be stranger than you thought. That it's one of several technologies which there's no obvious reason why can't happen and which would change things a whole lot. If you think of sort of one of the minor effects might be immortality, or at least no longer getting old, given a cell repair machine. Another one of the minor effects might be the complete destruction of not only the human race, but the entire biosphere via gray goo. And those both give you sort of an example of how wide... So that's one of my theses that came out of the book, really, is that people just underestimate how wide the range of possible futures are, that we're almost all conservative in that sense, and sort of assuming the future will be basically like the past, but the future tails wrong. Hasn't been true in the past, and I doubt it's going to be true in the future. All right. Only one of you was kind enough to provide issues this time, so I had to go through my extensive collection of issues past produced by other people in the past and found, I think, some interesting ones. Let me start with one from a previous year student, which is really, I think, a legal question for the under present law. Can a specific arrangement of molecules be considered as original works of authorship, fixed in a tangible medium of expression, and thus be protected under the current copyright law? So let us suppose that I go on a computer and I design a small nanotech device, a one-molecule motor, say. All right? And I make a precise description of that. Now, surely my written description could be copyrighted. It's a writing. Can I copyright the design itself? Anybody give me an opinion? Can I say, if I can't even build it yet, but after all, it's only patents that have to be even patents. You don't really have to reduce to practice, though you're usually supposed to. But I've got a full description of it. And can I say, well, if you build this device, that's just a translation into a physical arrangement of atoms of my copyrighted work. Therefore, you're violating my copyright. Anybody have an opinion on that subject? Yep.
First class, I don't think so. The analogies that come to mind have to do with small molecule drug discovery. And just because you can design a particular molecule, and those chemical compounds, they're not covered by copyright at all.
Why not? That is, if you think about, let me go back a step. Think about the history of computer programs and copyright law. Because as you may know, there was a period when it was really an open question. When some courts held that a computer program, a particular machine language computer program, was copyrightable and some that it wasn't. And the precedent that was cited that it wasn't was a player piano role, which really was a program in effect. I'm not sure what the precedent on the other side were. And it wasn't really settled by the courts. It was eventually settled by Congress. Was there any good reason? Think about the question, is there a good reason why computer programs ought to be covered by copyright law? I'm sliding a little from the original question, because what I'm really saying is, if you think about, we currently have two major systems for protecting intellectual property called copyright and patent. And one of the things that I think usually doesn't get much discussed is why. Why do we, if you're doing IP, you're going to study what are the requirements and so forth. Why do we have two systems? What's the fundamental difference? Why are certain kinds of intellectual property protected by one and one by the other? Yeah.
Well, in the case of computer software, that's more like an expression, so it makes sense that it's...
Why is it more like an expression? What are the essential characteristics?
Because once it exists, it is easy to replicate, and it's something that it creates. There's some originality necessary to create it.
That's true of a patented idea, too, though.
It is true, but that is what they're relying on to justify it. Whereas with a patent, there's a body of work and ingenuity that has to come forward that's more of a science as opposed to
But you have to have originality, because novelty is a requirement for patentability. No, but it seems to me your first point is an important one, that if you think about why we have copyright law, a lot of the underlying argument is that these are things which are costly to produce and cheap to reproduce. And then the concern is that if it's costly to produce and cheap to reproduce, then somebody, the first person produces it, but he can't make any money out of it because the second person can make a copy and undersell them. And you can say the same thing is true of patent in some sense, in the original idea. On the other hand, actually using that idea then involves implementing it in some way of your own, so it's not quite the same.
Well, isn't it sort of a timing issue? Because when you're creating software, you're essentially, it's the time from when you first think of the idea to actually coding it.
Yep.
That's a little finite piece of time, but until you actually create it, chances are most people aren't going to come up with the exact same idea as you, or if they do, it's functionally going to be similar, but it's not going to replace your idea scientifically.
Let me go back a minute, because it seems to me you've got a second point which is also very important. And that is, let me ask a different question, but it's related to, I think, what you're saying, if I got you correctly. Why is the term of patent protection much shorter than of copyright protection? Anybody? This is the fact. What?
Reasons. Unfair.
Give us one reason.
It's like the fair use part that if you get a patent, you can't. Fair use is one of them. We're just talking about it. The fact that you get to use it due to lawyers and patent, you just purchase it.
Let me go back a step. It isn't just why is it shorter. It's also that copyright is trivial to get. All right? This sheet of paper is copyrighted. All you got to do is to reduce it to a tangible form. I don't have to register anything. But in order to patent an idea, you've got to go through an elaborate procedure to persuade the PTO that it's novel and original and non-obvious and useful and a whole list of things. Why are we, on the one hand, so much more grudging of giving patent protection, and on the other hand, give it so for a much shorter period of time? Yeah?
Well, I think one obvious patent protection is absolute. You cannot independently come up with the same idea. And copyright, you can.
Except that if we think of ordinary copyright, it's not an idea. Ordinary copyright of written texts. The chance that you will independently come up with the same idea is zero. Essentially zero. In the case of software, it's a little trickier. But in the case of written things, I want to go back to your point about that nobody else is going to do exactly the same thing. Because suppose I write a book and copyright it. In one sense, I've reduced your future options. You now can't write that book and copyright it. How much does that matter to you? What is the chance that if I hadn't written the book and copyrighted it, you would have written exactly the same book and copyrighted it?
Zero.
Zero, essentially zero. On the other hand, if I invent an idea, we got lots and lots of examples of patent races. So if I invent an idea and patent it, I have suddenly reduced the options available to the rest of the world. Because now, even if you came up with the same idea half an hour later, it's still illegal to use it without my permission. Now, you could imagine a patent law that allowed for independent invention, but it would be very hard to prove. All right? Anybody know how you prove independent invention, the equivalent of independent invention in copyright law? Where does the equivalent of independent invention show up in copyright law? Anybody know? In what actual real world scenario?
Sharing the same source.
What?
Sharing the same source. The inspiration's drawn from the same common source.
Yeah, except it's hard to imagine that even if you and I are both writing descriptions of the same scene, that it'll be in the same words. No, there's a much more important case. Without independent invention, it is not clear that the IBM PC could ever have been cloned. All right, remember that under current law, copyright applies to computer programs. Imagine you want to build a computer that will run the same software as somebody else's existing computer. How do you have to do it? What you've got to do is to produce essentially identical machine code built into the ROMs of your machine. Not literally identical, but very, very close. Because what is built into the ROMs of your machine? Something of the form of put this number here, and that happens. For lots and lots of memory locations. So the easy way to clone the IBM PC would be to buy an IBM PC, read the ROMs, and copy them. That would be illegal under copyright law. The hard way, which is the way they really did it, is you buy a copy of the IBM PC, and you hire one team of engineers, and tell that team, look at those ROMs in exquisite detail, and give a complete functional description. Not a description of what hexadecimal number is in what memory location, but if you put this number here, that happens. For everything that matters. Now you hire a second team of engineers, they're your coders, and you say, all right, would you mind writing us some ROMs, design ROMs, which meet this functional specification? By the way, please be sure you never look at the description of the IBM ROMs from which the functional description was derived. And that's how it was done. What?
That's not copyright protected at all.
Of course they were copyright protected. Copying the ROM.
Of course, the ROM is copyright protected, but this kind of reverse engineering.
That's right. My point is that, but suppose what you came up with was the identical code. That's not so unlikely, because remember, your code has got to be functionally identical in great detail. If you think about how the built-in part of the operating system of the computer works, all right, put the number 7 in this number and in this place, and this happens. Even if it is identical, I don't know, maybe surprisingly he's looked at it since and seen it. Even if it's identical, it's still not covered by their copyright, because copyright does not prohibit independent creation. And the people who cloned the IBM PC went to a great deal of trouble to be able to show that they had written that software without copying it from the IBM PC. All right, so that's, I'm just mentioning it because that's sort of, as far as I know, the one really big historical case. I mean, sure, there have been other people done the same thing, but the important historical context in which it mattered that copyright law didn't cover it, and then mention Yale.
So to kind of boil it down, could you say that copyright law is really focused on the expression, whereas patent law is really focused on, you have a concept and you actually have to create the physical implementation of it?
I don't think so. That is, it's true that expression versus idea is the standard definition, but if you ask why are the laws different in the way they are, it seems to me that the underlying reasons are that copyright covers things which are costly to invent, costly to create, cheap to copy, and of which there's essentially an infinite possibility of doing them, such that one person doing it and owning it is not a significant restriction on other people. In economic terms, we say that there's no problem depleting the commons. Right? If you imagine an area of unowned land, and I say, I want to go in, put a fence around a part of it, chop down the trees, and claim it for me. All right, for those of you familiar with Locke's explanation of the origin of property rights, it's in that form. And Locke says, but there's a requirement. There's a requirement that when I do that, there be enough, as much and as good left for other people. At the point when we start running out of land, now when I go to the effort of claiming this land, I'm getting a benefit, but it's at the cost of the people who otherwise could have claimed it. All right? Ordinary copyright written up is allowing me to claim a piece of land from an essentially infinite forest, all of the books that could be written. Patent is letting me claim a piece of land from a finite forest, namely those ideas which at the moment it would be valuable to develop and use. Therefore, one reason to restrict patent law in the ways we do is that otherwise imagine that we had no requirements of patent law. I think of every useful idea I can and patent it. I've gotten a large routine, but I've contributed nothing because 95% of those ideas are obvious. Right. And people argue that does happen. It's not supposed to happen under patent. The other difference, I think, is that the cost of enforcing property rules depends a lot on how easy it is to recognize boundaries. So when I'm covering this stuff in law and econ, I like to tell the story of the island that floated down the Mississippi River. Sack Island in the Mississippi was an island that was upstream from an area where the west coast of the Mississippi belonged to somebody, and his property claim included all islands in the strip of the Mississippi parallel basically to his. Sack Island eroded upstream and deposited downstream and gradually moved south until it was in that stretch of territory. Did it belong to the person who had initially owned Sack Island, or did it belong to the owner of the land that was next to it? And the court, in my view, evaded the issue by claiming that adverse possession determined, I don't remember which way it went. But if you think about how difficult it would be to do property right in land if that was the normal situation, if bits of land were always moving around so that claims, much harder to work property rights, much easier to work property rights when it's very easy 99.9% of the time to say, this part's mine, that part's yours, yes, you were trespassing and you knew you were trespassing and I'm going to sue you for it, because look. There are a number of other interesting cases. I have a discussion that I came from somewhere of land rights in the Sudan along the Nile River. Because what happens is the Nile River keeps shifting. And the way they define it is that your land right is defined not by a GPS, but relative to the river. So every time the river moves 100 yards to the west, everybody's property claim to 500 yards to the west. I assume that if you keep going far enough west, you run into a desert that nobody wants, so it doesn't matter that you're moving into that. But that's sort of an interesting example of the problem of defining property when things don't stand still the way we're used to their standing still. Ideas have fuzzy boundaries. All right. If any of you end up as patent litigators, you will be making your living out of the fact that ideas have fuzzy boundaries. It's not instantly clear whether this is or is not an application of that idea. Have I mentioned to you Samuel Morse's attempt to patent the Internet? Samuel Morse's, I think, fifth claim, the last of the list of claims he made when he applied for a patent on the telegraph, was to all ways of using the electromagnetic force to convey letters or symbols to a distance. All right, so he was trying to patent the Internet, television, a whole bunch of other things. Now, it's true the patent would have expired by the time it mattered. He didn't get it. It was considered overbroad. But that sort of nicely illustrates the fact that it's not clear what he'd invented. And he wanted the broadest possible definition, of course, and the court narrowed it down. So I would argue that the one reason why patent law is as stingy as it is that we're worried about depleting the commons. We're worried about people patenting things not because they're really adding anything to human value, but just to get ownership of something scarce. And the other reason is that patent deals with things where defining property lines is hard, and therefore reusing the system of property and trade to allocate things is relatively hard. So if you imagine, if you think of sort of that, an alternative to private property is a commons. Right? A commons says anybody can use this. There are lots of commons out there. The air is a commons. The English language is a commons. It doesn't belong to anybody. And it makes sense to have a commons, either when there's an unlimited supply of something, which was true of air, at least until recently, or if it is very costly to observe and define property lines, enforce property rules, and so forth. And that my argument would be that patent is more depletable and less propertizable, so to speak, than copyright stuff, and that explains or at least justifies why we distinguish the way we do. All right? So now let's go back to our subject. This is sort of a digression from my standard law and econ class because I find it an interesting issue. There are a number of things which it seems to me that all law students and law professors ought to have thought about, and many of them haven't, and one of them is why patent and copyright law are as different as they are. And this is sort of my account of it. The other one is why tort law and criminal law are as different as they are, and why we have both of them when one of them would do the job, you'd think. I'll leave that for you to think about. But there have been real-world societies that functioned with essentially only tort law and no criminal law, or only criminal law and no tort law. I can give you an example of each, one of which lasted for a third of a millennium, and one of which for a couple of millennia, roughly. Anyway, so let's go back to whether specific arrangement of molecules. And the answer I would want to make is, if we can easily reproduce it, if we have the kind of technology that a nanotech general purpose assembler will give us, it then looks as though that's a copyrightable kind of thing. Because after all, there are an unlimited, more or less, number of possible arrangements of molecules. So when I have copyrighted my particular molecular engine, which gets power from somewhere or other and turns a wheel, which can then be used as part of a more complicated nanotech device, you can still make another one. You just have to arrange the atoms differently. All right? So it's just as when I've copyrighted my book, you can still write another book. It's not like I'm claiming copyright of the idea of a molecular engine. That would have to be a patent. Or even a way of doing a molecular engine. That would have to be a patent. I'm only claiming the right for this particular precise way of doing it. And that, it seems to me, I'm not claiming it would be copyrightable under current law, but if I'm right about why software eventually got counted as copyrightable, then the same argument applies. Yes?
I think if there's not that many atoms involved in the machine,
yes,
it would probably fall under the exception. And I think the name of it, or the...
Seems to fair.
Yeah, where it's too similar to the device, or too similar to the idea it's conveying.
That is,
the merger
doctrine.
Yeah, the merger doctrine, where the expression is too close to the message. Or the
right, that the way I think of it, and I think it's the same doctrine, but I may be confusing it, is that it's the case where, for this particular idea, there are very few possible ways of expressing it.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so
therefore...
You can't copyright a phrase such as, gets out stains, because there's only someone
yes,
who can say that.
Right. Yeah, that's... For some reason, I know of that in the French phrase, scenes off the air exception. I don't know why, but that's the form in which I remember seeing it. But it's the same idea. That's right. You're thinking of it as merger. Which
yeah, scenes off the air is like, it's like the common tropes of things that always happen. Yeah,
that's right. So no, I agree. So you might say, if it turns out that this is a six-atom arrangement, and there is only one six-atom arrangement that will do this job, then it sounds as though I probably can't copyright it. Maybe that might be true if I think about my diamond windshield. Or now that's a little tricky because there are diamonds out there already, but if it turns out diamonds have this problem that they cleave, you can split a diamond fairly easily along a particular plane. So you imagine that somebody comes up with a slight variant on the atomic structure of diamond, which is mostly diamond, but every fifth carbon is somehow done differently in some way, which prevents that problem. If there's only one way of doing it, you might argue that a copyright on that would be covered under the scenes of under the merger exception. But anyway, it just struck me that this is quite an interesting question because it starts you thinking about why, and it's a question which then is going to come up again. In fact, my question after it is really the same issue we've just been discussing. Nanotech raises many of the same economic users as computer programs. Ought designs to be protected by copyright, patent, or some new form of IP? And I guess the answer that I would offer would be the design qua design ought to be copyright. Ideas embedded in the design could be conceivably be patented if they met the ordinary. So if I figure out a clever way of building a machine so that my way involves some really elegant approach for disassembling an alcohol molecule in order to get the energy to turn a wheel, which will then drive some part of a nanomachine. That seems to me the sort of thing that could be patentable, whereas the actual design that I have is not. All right? And note that under patent law, if there is no need for my machine to be identical to your machine, even similar to your machine, it only has to embody the same patented idea, whatever that does or doesn't mean. This is
one of us. It's
you. There you are. Right. Oh, sure. Why don't you read yours?
Sure.
You confuse things because you're MS, and I've also got RM, who's Ralph Merkel, who is the guy who's sometimes given a guest talk here on this, one of the people involved in nanotech and various other interesting things. So, anyway.
All right. IP laws have to change to accommodate new concepts of nano authorship or nano. Who owns the rights to works created by nanobots?
Is this really a nanotech question? Why is this issue arising in the existence of nanotech?
The way that I'm thinking about it was that somehow I designed some nanomachine part of its programming is that it's going to maybe think of ways of solving a problem at the molecular level that I haven't thought of.
And the question is, does this depend on its being a nanotech machine? Why couldn't you do exactly the same thing with an ordinary computer?
Machine code or something like that.
What I'm saying is that I think this is a perfectly reasonable question, but it's an AI question, not a nanotech question.
Okay.
Right? That you're assuming the nanotechnology is how we build the AI, but it would be the same question if it was ordinary technology building the AI and it embedded things.
Yeah.
So we'll push this one up, that particular one up to next. Oh, if it's Wednesday, whenever we're doing AI,
sure.
It's probably Wednesday. The use of nanotechnology will lead to the development of new materials. When using common elements in a combination that, until the development of nanotechnology, is considered impossible, develops a new, stronger, lighter material, will its designer be given patent protection, or will the machines and programmers that run them be protected? So I come up with a nanotech process which creates carbon fiber, creates carbon-carbon-carbon-carbon bonds, which make an incredibly strong rope. We're going to use one to hang our space elevator for in another week or two when we get space elevators, which are one of the crazier fun ideas in futurology stuff. Can I patent the idea of carbon-carbon-carbon-carbon fibers? Yes or no? Or putting it in a way, I have patented it, and you want to infringe. What is your argument for claiming it's not patentable? That's an invalid patent. What condition of patentability have I not reached? That might be one. What else? That's right. How to do it wasn't obvious. Nobody had done it before in the history of the world. But the idea was perfectly obvious. Only you could arrange atoms. Carbon, 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 carbon. That's going to do it, right? So it seems to me that the answer to that question is that if the arrangement is an obvious arrangement, and the only problem is it couldn't be done, I might patent how I did it, but I can't patent the arrangement. On the other hand, if it was something really clever, going back to what I'm sort of thinking of as fiberglass diamond, going back to a diamond structure which doesn't have the one serious weakness of diamond, if I do that in some really clever and non-obvious way that never occurred to anybody before, including 70 other people who are trying to figure out how to do it, that sounds like a patentable invention, right?
But not the actual molecule.
Why not? Why can't I patent whether you call it a molecule or not?
Because even if I think it's impossible to make it, but I can't.
But I'm assuming the case where nobody else had figured out what to make as opposed to how to make it. All right, so imagine that the idea of a diamond that won't fracture is easy. But suppose it turns out to be the case that the only way of making a diamond that's really fracture-proof is that every 73rd carbon atom is replaced by a nitrogen atom or something which bonds across a different way. I don't know what it's going to be, obviously. Then it seems to me if that's not obvious, that's in principle patentable. So that it would seem to me that the material.
I don't think molecule itself is patentable for any process of machines.
Why wouldn't?
Because it'd be a law of nature, basically. There's no way you could prove that such a molecule or atom doesn't exist in nature. Obviously, we have to find out if
there are reasons. But you have no reason. There's no way that you could prove that any patented device doesn't exist in nature in that sense. Maybe it exists on some star three galaxies away. But if we're assuming a particular organized structure, which as far as we know there is no natural way of creating, then it seems to me that the evidence is overwhelmingly strong that it doesn't exist in nature. No?
Well, it would have to be pretty overwhelming.
Is Gore-Tex patented? Gore-Tex is a fabric invented by a guy called Gore, who is an inventor, which has various useful characteristics. It's used for sort of light, strong camping gear and things like that. And my guess is that it is or was patented. It might have expired by now. I believe that Gore is also responsible for the dental floss I use, which, unlike all other dental floss, doesn't break every time you try to use it. And I'm pretty sure that's the same inventor's thing. Yep.
Well, I'm wondering about the elements above 107, 108 that were all man-made, technically, but are elements, but are any of those patented?
I don't think so. I don't think that as an element is obvious in the sense in which what I'm describing is not, right? I mean, you just put together the right number of protons and however many neutrons it takes, so the thing is stable for at least a millionth of a second or so, and you got it. Whereas what I'm describing is actually an elaborate arrangement of atoms, which seems to me to look a lot more like. I'm not an expert on patent law, but I would have thought that if you actually constructed a material which was an original structure, so to speak. Nylon was patented, wasn't it? Well, nylon seems to be an example of this. If they patented the nylon itself and not just the machines that made the nylon, then that would seem to be analogous to this. Yep.
Yeah, when I think about that, I think of the classic case of the bacteria that eats oil.
Okay.
That's, I think, what you're trying to get at with the fact that this bacteria is naturally occurring, but you're engineering it, and that used to do something and it wouldn't otherwise do, and you're saying that...
At least the issue is hinting at that the materials are being combined in a way that they wouldn't do on their own. Mm-hmm. Is that how it's... Okay.
And it's not obvious, and you know, all the usual... and useful and all the usual sorts of stuff along those lines. There is a Supreme Court case on modifying a bacterium. I remember it was to eat oil or not, but they were putting vacuoles into the bacterium. It's, I ought to remember the name of the case, but I don't.
Jabardi,
that's right. All right, so let's... So it seems to me that if the material is obvious, then the way you produce it may be patentable, because that may well be non-obvious, but the material itself won't be. And so somebody else can come up with a new way of synthesizing the same material, and then you'll be out of luck. For nanotech patents, what is prior art? The design, but don't designs and products frequently merge? I.e., how many ways are there to design, say, wheat? An interesting question. How many ways, from a nanotech point of view, are there to design wheat?
What?
Huge number, right? Think of all the different varieties of wheat that exist, right? Every one of them has got to be molecularly different from the others. So is wheat prior art, or is the design of wheat novel simply because someone will be the first to create a wheat nanofactory? Are we back with the same answer, that the factory is patentable? If I come up with a version of wheat that is superior, if I can make a flour which somehow is more nutritious and easier to bake with and everything else than any natural flour, and then I might be able to patent that if that's not obvious. On the other hand, if I simply come up with a nanotech wheat, that doesn't give me the ability to keep you from coming up with a nanotech wheat, because the idea of using nanotech to produce wheat is an obvious idea, even if how to do it is not obvious. I think these are fairly straight questions. And since nano creation will be far cheaper than natural creation, what effect would you be there between owning a patent on a nanoproduct and owning a patent on a natural product, given the form we've... The answer is that you have your patent on your nanotech wheat. Fine, I'll just design a different nanotech wheat. And now I will compete with you. And my nanotech wheat not only is as nutritious as yours, it tastes better as well. And it also does a better job of trapping the carbon dioxide, so the bread rises, the gap is long, so it's much easier to use. In a world dominated, this I thought was an interesting one, in a world dominated by mature nanotechnology, so everybody's got it, it's readily available, everybody knows about it, what would the effect be on our society's view of property rights and its belief that a particular configuration of matter is an important property interest? He's not talking about intellectual property. He's talking about my ownership of this pair of glasses. Right? In a world in which nearly any object could be manufactured on-site from inexpensive materials, would the only really meaningful property right be the underlying intellectual property? What ramifications would this trend have on our current intellectual property law regime and so on? Let me go back. That's some of the end is intellectual property. I want to go back to the first question, which is, will our view of ordinary property change? And I question, first, people have ideas about it, and question, do we have any evidence? We don't have nanotech. But what this is really saying is, suppose you have technologies that the creating certain things becomes trivially easy. Does that change the degree to which we're willing to treat them as property?
Clearly, with online piracy of intellectual property in the last 15, 20 years almost.
That is, the legal system continues to treat it as property, but people largely don't. I have an even more immediate example. This is not my pen. This pen was sitting over there. I didn't have a pen with me and needed one. And in this particular environment, ballpoint pens are a free good, because you go into the law school office where the ladies work, and there is a shelf where you can take any ballpoint pens you want. And the result is that I find that in practice, All right. I am sure there are pens belonging to this law school that are sitting in my desk at home and are not, in fact, being used for law school purposes. Because it just isn't worth paying attention to whether the pen in my pocket at the moment is one that I bought at the drugstore for 50 cents or took out of the drawer for zero. All right. So it seems to me that the question is really raising an interesting point. And I was thinking sort of piracy in particular, but legal piracy as well. If you think about open source software, that to what extent... Now, that's not a bad example. Let us suppose that you use at work a computer which belongs to your employer, and it has a copy of OpenOffice on it. Won't you treat that not as property, in the sense that you have your laptop with you, you use your laptop for your own purposes, so you copy OpenOffice onto the laptop, because after all, OpenOffice is open source software, it's free, you could have downloaded it from the web for free. And the fact that that particular copy is, quote, the property of your employer in the sense of being on a piece of machinery that belongs to him becomes irrelevant to you. All right? So it does seem to me that an interesting question, if you sort of imagine a world where suppose computers are all backed up, and suppose that anybody who wants a beautiful MacBook Air 11-inch like the one I have with me all the time can get it by just downloading instructions from the super internet, stirring a piece of dirt, and zip, there's this lovely shiny machine sitting there. Well, you need a laptop, you don't have any dirt available, there's my laptop sitting there, you know I've got it backed up, let's go to the Chromebook so everything's backed up to the cloud anyway, so you pick it up and walk off with it. And, yeah, I don't mind. I mean, maybe I mind because I got to go to the trouble of stirring some dirt, but if you make it easy enough, as it were, and it seems to me that you then get a situation where certain things aren't getting treated as property because they aren't scarce. And this is, I should say, quite a general... one of the things that first started me thinking about the copyright patent issue was an article on Aboriginal property rights by somebody who was pointing out that some primitive societies have property rights in land and some don't. And it's tempting for us to say the ones who don't are just too primitive to have thought of the idea. It's such a wonderful idea. And then you discover that there are some primitive societies that have property rights in land part of the year. And the reason is that those are places where part of the year you're using the land to grow crops, and having private property in land is really useful for growing crops. Part of the year you're hunting animals across the land. And having private property and land is a real pain if you're hunting animals across, because while you're stopping to ask the owner permission to trespass, the deer is running away. So that got me thinking about the idea that what are the right property rules really do depend on sort of costs and benefits of different ways of enforcing, using, transacting, and so forth. And I have a chapter on this in my book, Law's Order, if anyone's curious enough. Yeah, you're right.
So the grid, I don't know if the law changes so much as the enforcement of the law changes.
That's right. That's right. Yes, yes. No, that's right. I think the law might change. All right. It's certainly possible that for certain things there will simply be no law against it. But it might be that just people will, the practice will change whether or not the law changes. And in fact, you can see it in the other direction in a way. There's a quite a good book by... The book is called Order Without Law, and it's by a Yale law professor, and I'm blocking on his name, although I know him. And it's largely about norms versus laws. And his central discussion is a location a couple of hours from here where for certain issues the law of the state of California does not run. And it's Shasta County, which is a rural county, and where there are norms of neighborly behavior which for certain kinds of issues effectively trump the law. And the reason they trump it is that one of the norms of neighborly behavior is that neighbors don't sue neighbors. And therefore, the cost of enforcing the California law is higher than the benefit. And he discusses as another example the behavior of academics in routinely violating copyright law. And I think there's less of it now than there was then. People have gotten more attentive. But certainly, for a long time, it was pretty common that you felt free to photocopy the Xerox an article that you had no legal right to copy and hand out copies to 20 people in your class. All right? And Why? Basically, because at this point, I actually occasionally get a check for, you know, people who've been copying some article of mine. And it's not entirely clear it was ever worth it, worth the trouble of enforcing those rules. But at this point, people are. But at least for quite a while, I think people mostly didn't bother to. And that was, again, a case where I think the feeling of a lot of people was the amount of money you'd actually pay somebody for rights to do this is trivial, the nuisance of doing it, the guy who you're photocopying is probably photocopying your articles too, because you're both professors and this is playing the same game, and so forth. But, yeah.
So maybe, like, take your pen example, right?
Yes.
So right now, the pen probably doesn't have much value. But say I had, that was my pen, and I needed it to sign a document, which in the next 5 minutes, very important to me. And you came in this
picture. Here,
have that. Yeah, but you came in this picture, and I would be frustrated, but I would go to court maybe to be more, like, proper stuff. Maybe I would think of something else, like, go to the press.
Yes.
Why were you in my house taking my pen? So you
should
think of different kind of ways to enforce, you know.
But a different way of putting it is that that's a case where the pen really is not of, of close to zero value, and that if the same thing happened except that you were in the law school three steps from the office where there's a drawer full of pens, then the issue would disappear.
Right, right. But say I wasn't, and, but I can't, I'm not going to reasonably distribute it to a court and say, hey, just want a pen.
Yes.
Court, but
yes.
I can't make up other arguments.
You might, yeah.
So for the same thing, like say someone took my MacBook Air, I didn't really mind that, but the time and energy that would take, maybe take an hour or something, and I had to go somewhere. So I would
could be.
Use a pen or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's certainly possible. But I think he's thinking of a mature nanotech as one in which for many things it's so trivial, sort of that you've got sort of sitting on your desk this machine, and you speak to the machine, and you say, give me a MacBook Air. And 43 seconds later, the MacBook Air comes clunking out of the machine. Yeah.
I suppose the legislature, the law should set value for other people's possession for that person.
Except we do have a doctrine of de minimis, which is setting value. It is saying there are some injuries so small that you can't get the law to correct them. De minimis non curat lex, about tiny things the law does not care.
You can still get a remedy which is nominal, but I think it's just the moral right, okay, I've proven that, yeah, I was wrong. Okay, you'll get a dollar for it, that's fine, but the law doesn't say, okay, just because it's damage wasn't there that you can't draw.
But it seems to me that in terms of our feelings, our moral feelings really are affected by these things. That nobody, let me take sort of one of the clearest cases, which is the academic world. We do not have patents on ideas. Anybody who writes a law and econ book, can borrow ideas. My friend Steve Landsberg, I think in one of his books, takes one of my ideas. He credits it to me, but it's a little bit of his book. And that doesn't feel to me like stealing. And part of the reason... Now, if you imagine that we were in an environment where these ideas were very valuable, very hard to come up with, where there was a real cost to me to his using my idea, then in that world, I would have different moral intuitions, I think. I think our moral intuitions are affected by the sort of costs associated with it. First time I can remember talking to Steve, incidentally, although I must have met him, known him before, given the context, was when he called up to ask if I minded if he lied about me in print. Because he was taking an argument I had made and turning it into a story. And, well, he was lying about me because the story hadn't happened, although I had offered the argument which he wanted to cite. So I said, no, I don't mind. He's an interesting guy. He wrote a book called The Armchair Economist, which is a pretty good sort of popular economic book. Better than Free Economics, or at least for teaching economics. I think not as good as my book, but we can disagree about that. anyway, so... Seriously, I thought that was a neat question, though, sort of thinking about how the technology would change... Maybe the law, maybe just the moral intuitions, the practices, that sort of thing, which I think was nice. Is taking an atom from an object, conversion from the owner of that object. More generally, how do we define de minimis effects and intrusions in a world of nanotech? Let's go back for a minute. Let us suppose that I come to your door, you're not home, and I go off again. And I take with me 6 grams of your property, laying me the mud on my shoes. Does anybody think that that is a legally actionable action? No. suppose I take with me 6 grams of your property, which consists of the paint that I just scraped off your car. Is that legally actionable? All right. What's the difference? Same amount of material. So let's go back to our Adams case. Imagine we've got fully developed nanotech, but the atoms I take are the dirt from your yard. No problem. Imagine we have fully developed nanotech, and the atoms I take are much smaller amounts. It's just 8 atoms, which happen to be the atoms that make your compressed air red blood cell stable. With those atoms removed, sometime in the next 24 hours, it's going to explode. And it's exploding means there will be a bubble of oxygen in your artery, which may kill you. Actionable. All right? So isn't that the right answer to the question? That the issue at present and with nanotech is not the number of atoms, it's whether removing those atoms does or doesn't impose serious costs on something. Right? I think that's the right answer anyway. I think at this point, with luck, you won't take any mud away if you visit my house, but a few days ago, you certainly would have. With the advent of nanoproducts that have the ability to re-engineer genes and cellular machinery, it would be conceivable for criminals to disguise their original fingerprints, retinal patterns, blood types, or even genetic material. What ramifications would such technology have on our criminal justice system and immigration laws? All right, so you want to claim that I'm the guy who committed a certain murder. And you have all sorts of evidence that I committed the murder. That is, you've got blood, you've done genetic testing, you've got video films of it. The only trouble is, my DNA isn't the same at this point. And furthermore, my face doesn't look the same. In fact, there is no evidence at all that I am the person that you have shown committed the murder. Or even, let us suppose that I did not take the alibi of the technology fast enough. So you tried to me for murder, you were about to convict me for murder, and I, you know, went off to the bathroom, and unescorted, which was foolish of them. My lawyer had slipped me the appropriate nanotech stuff. A different person walked out of the bathroom and walked out to the street and went out, and then when they looked in the bathroom, I wasn't there. How do you demonstrate that I am me? That the person who you just convicted of this crime is the same person walking around there? What do we do if we imagine technology so good that all of the ways in which you can identify a human being are no longer valid? Yep.
Find new ways to identify what makes a human being. Anything like the
but I've got a nanotech device I can arrange that. So you're coming up with a different answer than I have, but it's an interesting answer. One answer is, can you think of something measurable such that changing it is something you won't do because you won't be the same person? So if, for example, when we first arrested, take my second case, so my second case has the virtue that we can do all the testing we want rather than depending on blood stains and such, because there isn't a real solution for the blood stain version. But we can do all the testing we want when we first arrested you before you had a chance to change yourself. And we got a random sample of your memories. Suppose we somehow got a technology to do that. And we say, all right, change anything you like. If you change so much that a random sample of your memory is no longer mostly is the same, you're not going to be you anymore. And you've just punished yourself by killing yourself, so to speak. So that's one answer. I came up with an entirely different answer. Anybody want to guess what it was? How do we now steal?
Continuous sampling.
Train of, what's the term in evidence? Train of evidence, train of something or other? Think about a different version of the same problem. Here is this bloodstained cloth, which I, the prosecutor, claim came from the body of the murdered person. You, the defense, says, well, that's what you say. But after all, until you test with this bloodstained cloth, which has got the murderer's blood, not the victim, you didn't have any way of knowing what the bloodstained cloth that was on the victim was like. So how can you prove this is the same one? And how do you do it? By saying, because I've got people who will testify that this piece of cloth was taken off the murderer's body, was locked in a safe, that it was taken out of the safe by so-and-so and so forth. So chain of custody, is that right? Is that the right term?
That's right.
Yeah, I think it's chain of custody. So it seems to me that yours is one interesting answer, but the other interesting answer is we're going to do this in a transparent society. We've got video cameras everywhere. And by God, one of those cameras shows you walking into that bathroom. It shows you walking out, and we know what you look like afterwards. And if you feel like changing your face 6 more times, every one of those changes is going to be on tape. All right. So chain of custody seems to be the other solution to that intriguing problem. You could do a neat science fiction story, though, based on it. The first guy who does it, of course, gets away with it. And then they've got to figure out a solution. Once we have assemblers, most of the cost of a nanotech device is design cost. If we try to regulate nanotech, should we do it at the design end or the production end? So I'm imagining the regulations, some of this gets discussed later on, which I mean I get to, but we have a regulation which says you can't use nanotech to make marijuana. Or you can't use nanotech to purify uranium-235 for making an atomic bomb or for doing various things. And one way you could imagine trying to control it is to say it will be illegal for anybody to design a nanotech machine that does this thing. And a different way of controlling it would be to say it will be illegal for anybody to operate a nanotech machine that does this thing. Yep.
Without nanotech machines operating themselves.
I'm not quite sure what that means. Somebody's got to be feeding it raw materials. Somebody has put it where he put it. My car operates itself too, you know, for short periods of time.
if I'm understanding the question in this way, that is, like, say that a nano production device was more like a microwave, and everybody has.
Yes.
But maybe like certain digital video recorders or DVD burners, there was some digital copyright chip or something that prevented certain items from being produced. This is sort of what you're asking?
That was one of the two alternatives, it seemed to me,
right.
Would be either just by law, either just saying it's illegal to do it, or alternatively, somehow, every time somebody makes your nanotech microwave oven, just like DVD players are supposed to have a certain chip in them to prevent piracy, every nanotech microwave oven has got a chip in it which says you can build anything except X, Y, and Z. So that's one mechanism. The other alternative is to say creating the design that would be fed to that microwave oven is illegal, or maybe, depending on how you constrain it, but if you imagine that you create all the designs on very specialized computers for designing nanotech, somehow that computer is programmed so that it'll ring an alarm if you start building the wrong thing. Can you see problems with either of these approaches?
They both seem to have the same flaws in terms of, like you were saying, with digital rights management, in terms of we still have problems controlling the DVD player and preventing the media itself from being copied. So, I feel like...
So both of them are going to be hard to implement.
Yeah.
Are there other problems? Let us suppose for a moment that you are writing the program to prevent the nanotech machine from making marijuana. How do you define marijuana for purposes of that program? Suppose we got 3 different samples of marijuana and analyzed them at the molecular level. Do you think they'd really be identical? Very unlikely, right? It's a species of plant, but, you know, 2 different leaves aren't identical. Let alone the fact that there are surely many varieties of marijuana. People try to breed varieties that are particularly potent and so forth. And in fact, as you may know, marijuana is really an important industrial crop called hemp, except that the varieties grown for marijuana are varieties that are specialized to having the things that make it stuff people like to smoke.
All right.
One of the costs of marijuana prohibition is that we have no hemp industry, essentially, because it gets heavily regulated because of that you are all aware that George Washington grew marijuana. That is, he grew hemp. It was an important commercial crop. But anyway, you know, it was quite funny. I think it was Gingrich made some comment about how George Washington would have, you know, punished people for growing marijuana. And given that A, marijuana was not illegal until well over a century after Washington died, and B, that he did grow it, it struck me as a particularly silly statement, especially because Gingrich is a historian, right? He was a professor of history before he was a congressman. He's written historical novels. He's got to know that stuff. But sometimes your oratory carries you away. I can think of a number of prominent national politicians, including our current vice president, who say completely crazy things in the rhetoric, and you're never sure if they're strikingly ignorant or just to make a good line at the time. Anyway, going back from that digression. But anyway, so this is one problem. In any of these is how do you get a definition of what you're forbidding, which is clear enough so that either the oven or the design computer knows whether you're doing it. So that you don't really want to just prohibit an exact copy of this marijuana leaf. You want to prohibit any arrangement of molecules that will functionally work as marijuana, that will make people high in the same way marijuana does. Well, maybe you could do that. You'd have to know an awful lot to be able to program it not to do it. And, yeah.
Several varieties of marijuana, but they're not infinite or that many that you may not be able to say, all right, this.
Well, when you say several, not much infinite, but if you think of defining a variety not in terms of a breed, but in terms of an arrangement of atoms, don't you think that the number of possible ways, if you imagine that you sort of could have a molecule of cannabinol, which I think is the main active ingredient, almost surely there are atoms you could take off that wouldn't change its function, or atoms you could put on, or groups you could put on where it would still function biologically in the same way. And so you're really concerned with somehow all of the possible. I don't know enough to know. Maybe it's a small set, and then you could do it. But and I guess if you for U-235 it might be easier, because if you had some way of separating out that's a particular isotope, and you could just say you cannot do anything which recognizes U-235. Though actually, separating isotopes I think is non-trivial even with nanotech, but you might have a way of doing it. People know what isotopes are? For a given element, the element is defined by the number of electrons, which is the same as the number of protons. Same number of protons and electrons, different number of neutrons, gives you a different isotope of the element. The chemical properties are all determined by the electron shells, and therefore two isotopes of the same element chemically are very, very close to identical, which makes it really hard to separate them. But the atoms have a different mass, and so you can use various fancy techniques, which I'm sure the Iranians know all about. But
so, I was thinking like the active ingredient of medicine.
Maybe. I don't know enough to know if, in the general case, there is a single active ingredient that will do it, or a whole family of things that are biologically equivalent but not atomically equivalent. That distinction makes sense. I don't know enough to know. But if you were doing it for a moment, which is easier to do? To solve this problem at the design level or at the implementation level? What? Got limited resources, only a certain number of cops to enforce the law. You got to pick the.
No, I feel limited resources. Did you still increase enough pool of people who can actually go out and arrest? It's actually easier for you, right? You make more things illegal.
But if you can get rid of 99.9% of the problem with one end, it isn't worth spending very much to get the last 10. Any opinions on which end you'd rather? My argument, I'm not sure I'm right, is the design is much harder implementation, and therefore there are many fewer designers, and therefore fewer people you have to watch. That if you imagine that you're doing it at the microwave oven, there are 200 million microwave ovens in the U.S., let us suppose, the equivalent of microwave ovens, and just as with the DVD players, if I can somehow get the information to modify that chip, I'm in business. Whereas at least I don't know. You can imagine a case where you had computer programmers doing design that were easy, but it seems on the face of it as though designing nanotech things is going to be really hard because there are so many atoms in even a very small object. And if so, if there are only 1,000 nanotech designers out there, it's easier to say, well, if we catch you doing nanotech design, you're out. You know, we're going to execute you or something if you were designing a prohibited product. Anyway, this is one of Ralph Merkel's, which I'm not sure how interesting it is, but let's see. Presuming international law will be applied, presumably to nanotech, what international laws might we adopt? What international laws would various countries agree to? Who would enforce such laws? All right, so let's suppose we're really scared about gray goo kinds of problems, and maybe about tailored plagues and such. So we say we're going to try to set up an international convention which says that no country may have unregulated nanotech, and every country must have regulations of nanotech which require that any self-reproducing nanobot have the following safety precautions built in to prevent it turning into gray goo. So, or maybe you can't make any self-reproducing nanobots. Maybe that would be the simplest. Maybe that's the simplest rule, that you can see that there will be some uses for self-reproducing nanobots, but you're not allowed to do it. So, how is that going to play out in the international law context? Anybody?
I don't know what the current law is for regulating nuclear weapons.
That does seem the obvious example, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I even if there is such regulation, I have a very pessimistic view of international organizations and their ability to...
What there is at the moment are treaties among countries, one of which Iran is currently signatory to, and it is reasonably clear that if pushed too hard, Iran will just withdraw from that agreement. At which point, legally, you know, somebody can drop bombs on them, but legally speaking, as far as I can tell, they're in the clear. Because nuclear is an interesting case because there has been a massive attempt to prevent countries from getting nuclear weapons. It is true that most countries don't have nuclear weapons, but it is also, I think, true that any substantial country that really wants them, of which Iran is the current example, is going to be able to get them. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me. And insofar as it can be prevented not by law, but by military force. So that, you know, you could imagine if we hadn't had the Iraq War, say, if we hadn't had Iraq and Afghanistan, and Iran was doing what it's doing, it then is at least believable that the U.S. would say, all right, there's a limit to this. You stop in 24 hours, or we're going to start dropping bombs on you. And if that doesn't do it, we'll send in the troops. My guess is that conquering Iran would be very hard. It's a large country, a lot of people. But my guess is that the American army is better than the Iranian army, and therefore any particular location, such as the place where their centrifuges are, we could hold for 24 hours while we wiped out all of the stuff. So my guess is that it would be possible to use military force to prevent that, although it's not practical given the current politics and the fact that Americans have gotten quite enough wars of late and aren't willing to do any more, I think. But you have a similar problem here, except that if anything, it's going to be harder to spot. All right, you don't need to buy lots of uranium from somewhere. Iran's...
talking about government actors are very large actors or very easy to control, whereas I think nowadays it's more like biotech. Anybody can
order a kit from a... But it may depend when. It may depend when, because in the early stages of nanotech, it's going to be very, very expensive to make that kit. It's going to be very expensive to do the designs. So it might well be that there is a stage at least. And if all of the countries agree we aren't going to let kids get cheap. We're going to make it illegal to develop private nanotech production facilities. So our nanotech will only be in government labs, and we agree to the following restrictions on what we do. So you can imagine that world.
Human cloning, is that regulated right now?
I don't know what regulated means.
I mean, is there a treaty between the...
I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know. But that would be very hard to prevent. Of course, it happens routinely, but you mean artificial cloning. Right? I mean, one of the years I was teaching this class, one of the students announced she was a clone. She was an identical twin, so she was a clone. In fact, she was right. But in that sense, yeah. But also, it's hard to see any reason why. I mean, people do appear to care, but as far as I know, there aren't, in fact, very strong reasons. I mean, that you could certainly argue it's a bad thing because the first few times aren't going to work very well. But look, the government of Syria is killing thousands of Syrians, and they aren't being stopped from doing that. That's a much much larger human cost than five babies being born of whom three are defective, which might well happen when you first time started out cloning people, right? So in that sense. But that's a different issue. But in any case, part of the problem, it seems to me, with banning it is that it is extremely useful for ordinary peaceful purposes. That if you think about nuclear, to begin with, it's not really clear that Iran gets a very large benefit for having its own nuclear technology, even weapons aside. There could be some conveniences, but they can buy radioactive stuff for medical purposes from someone else. They have lots of oil to produce power with. So the incentive for them, for non-military purposes, to want a peaceful nuclear technology, although it exists, isn't very huge. Whereas if you imagine that nanotech is becoming possible, the benefits you can get from having a nanotechnology are going to be very large, so that's going to make it hard to repress it. And once you've got it, the step from peaceful to non-peaceful looks like an invisible step, whereas in the case of nuclear, at least we can say, well, look, are they refining uranium to higher, richer levels than they need for peaceful purposes, and ultimately have they just tested a bomb? It's sort of hard to test a bomb and keep it quiet. No, it's impossible to be an underground test, maybe, but that'll show up on seismographs. So in that sense. Though it's an interesting question. Does anybody know if the Israelis ever tested a bomb? Everyone believes that Israel has at least a nuclear arsenal, maybe thermonuclear, I'm not sure. And the standard story is that it was a collaboration with South Africa, which has lots of uranium. South Africa also has an awful lot of land. The idea of testing nuclear weapons in Israel is just sort of crazy. I mean, do it in the Negev Desert, maybe. But there were glasses
right there. Are those yours?
Thank you. Is this your pen, by any chance?
Just my glasses, not
just your glasses. All right.
Going back to the testing the bomb, yep. I want to say there was some test, but I couldn't remember.
I'm sure there was never a public one, because Israel's never publicly admitted having nuclear weapons. But there might have been news stories about seismographic evidence that made people think that there was a test.
And it was either suspected to be the Pakistanis or Israelis.
But South Africa would be the obvious place to do it, because it's a big country with lots of empty as well as non-empty territory.
This one was underwater, too.
That I don't know about. But my impression is that it's sort of, I don't know what the evidence is, but considered an open secret that the Israelis and South Africans, of course, also wanted a bomb, and they, like the Israelis, they were in the situation of being a relatively small country in terms of population with lots of people who hated them, and that's a good natural enough reason to want a bomb, right? There's a Tom Lehrer song about proliferation, but anyway, I don't remember it, so I won't oppose it. This is yours, right?
Okay.
Yes, read it. That was sort of an interesting one.
Oh, yeah. Under the current FDA definitions, drugs work chemically and devices work mechanically, or mostly. How do these definitions change, if at all, to accommodate nanotechnology? And sort of what I was thinking about was, you know, if you, let's say, inject a syringe full of nanoscale machines that attach to whatever, your nervous system, to those pain receptors, and, you know, take away the pain, the effect of this mechanical device is much like aspirin, which is a drug that has a chemical effect. So I think what would have to happen is kind of reassessing how those definitions come into play and based more on the effects on the body.
Well, except for the mechanical device, people who do acupuncture claim that that will stop pain, and that's really mechanical. Putting it differently, where would you... It seems to me that you're right that there is a sense in which nanotech devices are an awful lot of chemistry. You can think of a of aspirin is a nanotech device, right? It's a molecule, salicylic acid, however you pronounce it, which does certain things when it interacts with you. But then what would be the natural, assuming, I'm not sure you need a distinction, but suppose you wanted a distinction. Once we have nanotech, what are the two categories that correspond to chemical versus mechanical?
I'm not sure what you're asking, chemical versus mechanical.
With our current technology, it seems to be useful to classify things as either chemical or mechanical. I'm not sure it really is. I don't know about regulation of medical things. And so then the question is, in a world with nanotech, when, as you point out, there will be things which are mechanical in the sense that we built them to do something which function like chemicals, and you could argue that chemicals are simply machines that we didn't build but that we discovered, where would it make a sense to make a distinction? What might you distinguish between instead of chemical versus mechanical?
Yeah, that is good.
Anybody else?
Chemical kind of dissolve in your body, let's say if it was medicine and becomes part of you, you will
throw those. Cell repair machine dissolves in my body, becomes part of me. I'm not going to throw those things away. They're going to keep going through my body, so every cell gets checked every 3 hours. So if anything goes wrong with anywhere in my body, it's fixed.
So they retain their identity, a separate identity as a parasitic creature on you, but it's a separate identity as versus you take Tylenol, it dissolves in it.
Well, chemically, it presumably dissolving isn't going to mess it up. Chemically, it may in fact interact with you and change, but then presumably
you won't retain its identity. You can't say, okay, this part of you is Tylenol.
Well, if you look small enough, then you might be able to find a molecule of Tylenol in you. I don't know. I don't know enough about how they work. But you could also imagine the nanotech device, which changes in you as it does its job, right? The distinction I was thinking was between things where their function depended on the atomic scale structure versus things where the function depended on gross assemblages of atoms. So if you think about the needle being used for acupuncture, changing where one atom is doesn't have any effect on it. Changing where 1,000 atoms is won't have any effect on it. Maybe a quadrillion, it'll get less sharp or something. Whereas aspirin, remove one atom, and depending what atom it is, it might well be that it had no function and no effect, that it no longer works. And a nanotech machine, remove one atom, and depending what atom it is, it may stop working. So if you, insofar, I'm not quite sure what the reasons are for different regulation, but it seems to me that that the old distinction carries over conceptually the distinction between things that whose design is atomic scale and things whose design is much larger than atomic scale. And that might
work. Does it work the other way? Like if you add an extra atom to it?
Might also. Might or might not. You know, if you add an extra piece to your to the gears of your car, it might stop working very well, right, depending on the piece. Let me skip your next one because it's less interesting to have you read the one after that, which is the one that starts currently.
Currently, the federal government almost always has near unlimited use to technologies developed using federal funds. If federally funded research begets the first generation of nanobots, and those nanobots build the next generation of nanobots, the cycle continues down several iterations. Just how much will government be entitled to? Everything that flows from the original nanobot technology?
What happens with the equivalent in current law? Let us suppose that the government funds the development of a computer. And let us suppose that part of the deal is they now have an unlimited license. Maybe the computer gets patented. The idea is the computer gets patented, or the software gets copyrighted. So they have an unlimited license to use it. You privately buy one of those computers, and you use it to write a new word processor. Does the government have any special rights with regard to that word processor?
Yes, generally they pretty much get anything developed. Well,
they haven't funded your research.
Right, they haven't funded the research. So it becomes a problem, I think, that is sort of like tracing in like community property, where you have the divorce and this was separate property before and this was after, and you have to go through.
But I don't see where the problem arises, because I would have thought that their right is only the right to the intellectual property rights for that particular thing that was developed. And that has nothing to do with intellectual property rights for things that were created using it.
So I think, yeah.
Look, you have a, you, 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 you're Microsoft. You own the copyright on Word. I use Word to write a novel. Microsoft doesn't have a copyright on that novel.
Oh, no.
Isn't this analogous? Am I missing something?
Well, no, I think the government's not going to be owning the intellectual property, but they have unlimited use right to it.
To it, but not to things that other people create using it, I don't think. Am I wrong? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think that's generally the case. So.
All right, well, I think we're out of time anyway. So I hope you all have gotten your taxes done. As I may have told you, one of the early classes I taught here, I discovered that the woman who was auditing the class was the wife half of the husband-wife team that had created the software I did my taxes with.